coming to you from Volcano, the planet Spork is from in Space Trek, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Liberal Arts. I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
And between the three of us, we may start the podcast.
Eventually.
Possibly.
Eventually.
At some point in the near future.
Y'all, it's been like half an hour since we got on this call.
Really? Hey, Cleo, do you have a fun fact for us?
I do, and I'm so excited about it. I've already been talking about it, and both of you are very confused, so it's great. Gonna bring some clarity to your confusion and give you a fun
fact
about.
Thank goodness.
Will you, though?
Try me.
I'm scared now. I'm so scared.
So I am very happy to say that I'm going to bring you some fun facts and some clarity about this political situation.
Oh, no.
It's political?
Which one? It is. It's like mildly political. In that it happened, like, it involved politicians. So.
Do we have to talk about politics?
You're gonna love this, I promise. Everyone's gonna love this. So, as you all know, the United States has diplomatic missions across the globe, and our embassies fostering goodwill among the countries, and also looking out for our own citizens in other countries. And recently, while doing a training of some new employees on the email alert system, the U.S. Embassy, one of our embassies in Australia, was trying to do a test email.
Oh, no.
And
this kind of story never ends well.
And apparently, they were much better at working the email system than they thought they were, because their test email went live. And instead of just a silly internal, this is a test, let's put some goofy stuff in it, yay, it worked, lots and lots of U.S. citizens in Australia got an email invitation inviting them to, well, first of all, this email invitation contained a picture of a cat lounging in a chair dressed like the Cookie Monster.
Okay, all right, good.
And it was inviting them. A personal invitation to a cat pajama jam at the U.S. Embassy in Australia.
Well done. How many people showed up?
None that I'm aware of, because they
realized
what happened, like, and had to send out a follow-up email saying, we're very sorry, that was a training test, we didn't expect it to actually go through to real people, there is no cat pajama jam, please don't come.
No, that is the incorrect response, so, America. The correct response is to send out an email saying, we're so sorry, but we are hosting it anyway if you would like to come. The correct response is to host the party.
The U.S. Embassy in New Zealand got a hold of this because they had to send it out over Twitter as well. Like, so the U.S. Embassy in, I think it was Canberra, is tweeting their apologies for inviting everyone to a cat pajama jam. And the U.S. Embassy in New Zealand is tweeting back, yo, where's our invitation? We didn't get one. Guess we'll have to host our own.
Did they?
I don't think they did.
Dang it! What is wrong with this planet?
Okay, all right, but two things. Mm-hmm. A question and a comment.
Yes.
The comment is this. That's the most New Zealand thing I've heard all day. Guys, what is a pajama jam?
I don't know, but I kind of want to have one.
It's just a gathering of cats wearing pajamas. Come on, what more is there to get?
In that case, I'm so in. I don't even know how in I am.
I'm sure there's a DJ, because it's a jam. Or there's biscuits.
Of course, okay.
Maybe there's a DJ.
I'm trying so hard to not start singing Space Jam, y'all. Trying so hard. Come on, it's late. Oh, I failed.
No.
So yeah, that's your political fun fact for today.
Thank you so much. Goodness.
I hope that this brings you the most joy that anything political has ever brought you.
That's about right. So we're going to do another leg of the mythology round today, aren't we?
Yeah, because I'm too lazy to talk about turkey.
And I'm too busy to talk about
radio.
We've
committed to the bit at this point. Like, we can just go on the myths until I run out, so y'all have a lot of time. I feel like we've committed now.
I appreciate that a lot. I'm trying to do research. So, yeah.
I have multiple documentaries on genocide to get through before I can do my next two colloquiums. Okay. So.
Well,
wow, that sounds rough.
Yeah. In the midst of y'all's deep research and watching terribly sad documentaries, welcome back to Rissa's Very Chill Story Corner.
Yay!
I've realized, by the way, that... these stories would be way better on a slightly different podcast, not to diss our own stuff, but, like, if I was tipsy and allowed to curse, this would be a much better storytelling experience, I have to say.
There is a podcast like that. So if you like Riss's Very Chill Story Corner, you should check out Spirits.
No, Hannah, I want to make this podcast. Don't take it from me.
It's too late. Spirits is too good.
Okay, but is it about Greek mythology?
It's about all mythology.
Rude!
You can be a guest host. You should email them.
I'll talk to Julia about and demand having you on to the guest.
No, I wanted my own podcast! No, I'm just kidding. I'm so disappointed now.
This story corner just got a little less chill.
Okay.
What? Tell us some myths and legends.
Yeah, okay. So... I've been thinking for a little while how to curate these stories, because who knows how many episodes I will be doing. And I want to get to a lot of different things. Last time we did a quick intro to the Pantheon, and this time has a few ways it could go. There are loads of other stories about all the gods I introed last time, but if I start those, it's just going to be really chaotic, because all the stories are going to start interrupting each other. So I was looking for other ways. I was like, I could walk through the constellations, I could list a very long series of women Zeus has slept with, but that would never end. And it's gonna get chaotic one way or the other. So I thought I would just try my best to continue what we started last time, which was the creation story. Because surprise, we're not actually done with that. Last time, I told y'all about how Mother Earth and Father Sky had some terrible children. And those children had some more terrible children. But this still hasn't done a lot to explain the world we live in, which is really a key feature of most mythologies. So you guys know a little bit about Greek mythology, maybe more than I take you for, but any guesses on who created mankind?
Zeus.
Nope.
Zeus on accident because he slept with someone. No.
Nope.
Is it a Titan? It feels like a Titan.
It is.
Okay.
Okay, so it's actually two sons of, well, one son. Well, let me back up. So, there are these Titans. There's actually three brothers. One of them is Atlas. We will have to get to Atlas later. The other two are Prometheus. I bet you've heard of Prometheus.
Sure have.
And his brother, Epimetheus. Not a lot of people have heard of Epimetheus. These brothers' names literally mean forethought and afterthought.
Well, that's depressing.
That I know. but rude. it's not about their birthing order. It's about how they themselves function. So let me explain. Zeus basically tasks these guys with creating creatures to populate the Earth. After all of big wars between the gods and the Titans settled down, they were like, oh wow, lots of people died. We should probably fix this. Prometheus and Epimetheus are up to this task. And as their names suggest, they handle this in very different ways. Epimetheus, whose name is Afterthought, dives right in. They have a whole bunch of, like, cool gifts to hand out to these things they're creating. They've got, like, super speed and good eyesight and strong jaws and flight and breathing underwater and all that stuff. And so he makes a lot of really cool animals. All of them, actually. He builds all of the animals, and he's just handing out these gifts left and right. He makes cheetahs really fast, he makes elephants really big, he makes birds able to fly, that kind of stuff. And his brother, Prometheus, spends this whole time, Prometheus is the one whose name means forethought. He spends this whole time working on one single masterpiece creation. But by the time he's done making it, all the other good gifts have already been given out. He can't give this creation super speed or super strength or claws or camouflage or wings or even fur because they kind of ran out of those things.
Thank goodness.
I'm gonna be straight up with you. This is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
We are and, out of fur.
Yeah, it's like, well, I mean, you put a lot of planning in this, but all the good stuff's gone, so I guess you'll just have to make do with these wimpy bodies. And so Prometheus asks Zeus to give one gift to his creations to ensure that they will not suffer and die. Fire.
Yes.
And Zeus...
I've never heard the lead up to this.
Yeah, I know, right? People always talk about the second thing. So he asked to give them fire. And Zeus, being the absolute butt that he is, says, "No way. Fire is our thing."
Of course he does.
So Prometheus, who has just finished making mankind and is the hero of our story, sneaks into the sacred hearth of Olympus and steals a burning coal. He hides it and carries it back down to the humans below and gives it to them and says, "You must never let this sacred flame go out." And with this gift of fire, mankind is uplifted. And this story is not just about physical survival or the ability to cook meat or whatever. Fire represents man's power over nature, but also man's power over light. And I mean like the metaphorical sense of light. This is about enlightenment. Prometheus's gift of fire is also the gift of reason and understanding and the gift of self-knowledge and the gift of God knowledge, the ability to look beyond oneself and look up and observe and everything that makes people human. A lot of that is kind of encapsulated in this idea of fire.
The red flower.
Thanks, Jungle Book.
Yeah, so there's this kind of idea that, like, with the smoke rising, so rose the thoughts of men, and then they became aware of the gods and all that stuff. And humans use their gift well. They use it to, you know, survive and warm themselves, but they also use it to honor the gods with burnt sacrifices. So when Zeus sees all these fires on Earth, he's pretty pissed, and he knows Prometheus did it. But he doesn't actually punish Prometheus yet. Everyone thinks that Prometheus gets punished for stealing fire, and he kind of does, but it's mostly for this other thing. So Prometheus needs to take this a step further. He looks out and sees all of his creation using this fire and making sacrifices, which all the other gods are like, awesome, sacrifices, we like those. just to say, in Greek myth, the gods eat ambrosia and drink nectar. They don't eat burnt sacrifices, but burnt sacrifices are described as, like, the seasoning to their food. So, like, they don't need burnt sacrifices to survive, but it sure smells good.
Gotcha.
Is kind of the idea. But anyway, but Prometheus sees these people, killing all of these cows and things, and he thinks, well, that kind of sucks. You guys worked hard for that. And it's very hard to grow economically successful when you're killing half of your herd just to burn them. So... he comes down and tells a couple guys to butcher an ox and divide up the parts of this ox into four piles. A pile of sinew and bone, the meat, the entrails, and the fat. And then he takes the sinew and bones and he puts it on top of the meat. He hides the meat. And then he takes the fat and he hides the entrails. So he's got these two bundles, one which looks bad but has all the meat in it, and one which looks very good but is actually mostly entrails. And he invites Zeus to come down and says, you know, as you're the king of the gods, you should choose what will honor the gods more. What would you like these humans to offer you in sacrifice? And Zeus, picks the one that looks best, the one covered in fat, because the fat's the good part. And as this contract is binding, when Zeus finds out that this means he gets none of the meat and the humans get to keep all of the good stuff, he is pissed. Not only have humans, through Prometheus, stolen from the gods, they have also cheated the gods. And that's not cool.
Wow. Wow.
So, Zeus's revenge is one of the more famous myths. He ties Prometheus to a mountaintop with unbreakable chains, where every day an eagle comes to eat Prometheus's liver. And as he is immortal, every night the liver grows back and the cycle repeats again. It's not a pretty picture.
No, that would kind
of
suck.
It's yeah. also not the last of these unpretty pictures we'll see. This is kind of a thing. But anyway, speaking of pretty picture, so far, mankind has gotten off pretty easy. We got fire, we got cow meat and stuff. But Greek myth also explains the rotten parts of life. And some people would say that this is kind of another stage in Zeus's revenge for that whole cheating him thing. Y'all have probably heard this one before. So this is a story about a woman made specifically by the gods. They say she was, you know, made by Hephaestus and brought to life by Athena and given beauty by Aphrodite and given a gift of intelligence by Zeus.
This is
a specifically
set up for success.
Quite of curiosity.
Around the whole world. I know who this is.
Okay, what? Yeah, you know. She is given in marriage to Prometheus's brother, Epimetheus. And even though his brother specifically warned him never ever accept a gift from Zeus, Epimetheus is like, but she's great. And like,
Captain
I agree, she sounds like a terrific woman. Like, she's smart, she's pretty. Like, she's amazing. She's made by the gods for Epimetheus, and he's, like, awesome. He lives on Earth, so they move there. Her name is Pandora.
Yep.
And she's given a box. And y'all know this story. Pandora, the very curious woman, is given a box and told that she must never, under any circumstances, ever open the box. And so she opens the box.
Well, of course.
The box, unfortunately, contains all the woes of mankind. So she opens the box just enough to take a peek, and out fly deceit and despair and envy and gossip and corruption and drudgery and every bad thing that can afflict mankind. All manner of awful things. Before she shuts the lid again. She does eventually get the lid shut, although just in time to keep one last thing inside the box. Hope. Now, this metaphor has been treated differently in different places, and to be frank, I'm not sure I understand it. Like, wouldn't you want hope out in the world? So I think some people have translated it as kind of like, because the other things came out, there was no hope. And some people have translated as more of a, no, this is good because we need to hold hope close to us and hang on to it and not let it go. And I'm not really sure which way the Greeks would have understood this one.
I didn't realize that hope was kept in the box. I was always under the impression that hope was the last thing to come out of the box.
Yeah. No, it's kept inside the box. Yeah. It's the only thing that does not escape. But in any case, whether this is good that hope is in the box or bad, everything is terrible for a while. And eventually Zeus does something about it, because the Pelagians is what these people, these humans are called. Pelagian is really just a word the Greeks used to mean everybody who lived here before us. They were just terrible. These are the people that Prometheus made, specifically, this will come up later, made out of clay. And wouldn't you know it? No world mythology could possibly be complete without a flood narrative.
Yay.
Oh, of course.
Yep. Greek myth has a flood narrative, too. Our Noah figure is this guy called Deucalion. He's the son of Prometheus. And Prometheus can see the future, you see. So his son goes and visits him, and he can't really help his dad at all, but he can be there, you know? He's trying to be a good son. So Prometheus tells
him. It's like visiting someone in hospice, except
exactly.
They're chained to a rock about to get a bird eating their liver out. What the heck?
So Prometheus, while his son is visiting, is like, oh, hey, by the way, Zeus is going to snap one of these days and flood everything. So you should probably make a boat. And so he does. And lo and behold, this flood comes, and everybody drowns except Deucalion and his wife. I don't really know what happens to the animals, but in any case, even the Greeks realize that, It's awfully hard for just one couple to repopulate the Earth through the normal means. So, when they finally are able to return to solid ground, it's something like 10 days later. Anyway, they use... Oh yeah, that was the other thing. Prometheus told them, when you make this boat, make sure to bring an ember of the sacred fire I gave you with you on the boat, so you don't lose it. Yeah. So, they have this ember, and when they finally get back to solid ground, they light a fire and make a sacrifice to the gods, thanking them for their lives and the fact that they're not dead.
Which and is this... kind of, that's kind of an ironic thing to do, since it's the gods who put in this little mess.
Well, so maybe it's like, to current resident, not Zeus, sort of thing.
Maybe so. Yeah, maybe it's
everyone
to Prometheus.
Except Zeus.
Well, it does have the very singular result of causing Zeus to realize what an absolute dick he's been. That doesn't happen often.
It's the only time it's ever happened!
Yeah, so it must have been a good sacrifice. So he tells them to throw the bones of your mother over your shoulder.
What?
And in this case, the bones of your mother means Mother Earth. So these people are made from clay, right? Mm-hmm. So the bones of Mother Earth are rocks. And so they pick up some rocks and throw them over their shoulders. And as the rocks hit the ground, up pop a bunch of people.
That's
men
not
and women.
How that works.
This time, the new and improved model made from stones instead of clay. Super convenient, right?
Okay.
Anyway. Those original humans made from clay, the ones that got all terrible after Pandora's box, they were less equipped to deal with all this crap than the stone people are. And to be honest, I'm still trying to figure out if this is supposed to be a general story about the improvement of mankind, or if this is some weird way of the Greeks being strangely nationalist and racist, but I don't know. And nationalism wasn't super a thing back then, so we're just gonna pretend that this is an okay thing to say.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, spoilers for later. This isn't going to be the last time Zeus just invents a ton of people out of stuff that gets thrown on the ground. It's one of the funner parts of Greek myth is that can happen sometimes. I always picture it like that. In The Magician's Nephew, where you just throw something on the ground, it grows. But this time he's just like, we're just going to throw something on the ground and, ooh, a boy! Like,
this is
I don't know.
Reminding me of when I did... When I did my Trail of Tears class and we were studying Cherokee creation myths, and one of them was like the first man and the first woman wanted to have a family, so we slapped her with a fish and they had a bunch of kids.
Is that what we're calling it these days?
So oh, we goodness. Spent the whole rest of the weekend being like, wow. And he slapped her with a fish.
We've just got a bumper crop of boys here, don't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, just a good bush of boys. So, yeah, human beings as we know and love them have finally arrived on Earth. And there's a lot of them. Like, so many. And the gods get all up in their business, because honestly, what is the point of having a human race if the gods can't come in and ruin everything? But... I think we're going to have to wait till next time for most of the human myths. What I really wanted to look into today... aside from humanity, is more stories that the Greeks have about why the world is the way that it is. So not all their stories are about this. Not every story is like, and that's why we have earthquakes, or whatever. There's a lot of just adventures, but they do have some stories that are very much explaining natural phenomena.
Right.
So I wanted to get into a couple of those.
Yeah.
Because they just have a really interesting way of seeing nature. Some of it I'm sure you've encountered before, but, and I don't really have time to get into all the interesting stuff, but anyway, let's just start. Okay. So I mentioned last time the three children of one of the Titans, Helios, Selene, and Eos. That is the sun, the moon, and the dawn. These are personifications of these elements. There's also personifications of the four winds. Boreas, the north wind. Notus, the south wind. Zephyr, the west wind. And Eurus, the east wind, I believe. Eos and Selene both have stories of just kind of like, you know, Greek myth, just myth in general is often about kind of trickery and wordplay and little stupid mistakes. So Eos, example, she's the dawn. And one day she falls in love with this mortal who is always awake at dawn. And she comes home and pleads with Zeus to grant him immortal life so that they can be together forever.
He makes him the sunset, doesn't he?
No. Oh. No. But he makes him immortal. He makes him unable to die.
It's really important to me that she fell in love with him because he's a morning person, yeah?
I guess. I don't know.
God bless. That's so good.
She didn't see him every morning.
There's someone for everyone.
Well, here's the trick. Zeus was like, yeah, sure, I'll make him immortal. He can't die anymore. But Eos forgot to ask for immortal youth. And so, unlike herself, her husband, Tithonus, grows older and older and older, but never dies.
Oh, really?
And as he ages, he gets smaller and frailer and smaller and frailer until he shrinks down to the size of a bug.
Oh my gosh! Specifically,
he becomes the first grasshopper.
Oh my gosh!
And now I would have said that's why grasshoppers are always around to greet the dawn, except that they aren't. They're normally out at sunset, so you know what? You can't have everything with myths.
Wow.
I love that so much because you do. You look at a grasshopper's face, it looks like a little old man.
Little man. Yeah.
That's so horrible.
So a related story.
But I love it.
Eos has a sister, Selene, the moon, who learned from this mistake. Mm. She fell in love with a mortal too, a shepherd who was often up at night. A shepherd who she often saw sleeping in the fields. And so she asks, instead, that he be eternally remain beautiful. But the catch to this is that he will be in an eternal sleep. But Selene can look on him, as, you know, every night as he sleeps there. Look is what the children's books of myths say, but she did bear him, like, many children, so make that what you will. But at least he's not a grasshopper, I guess.
Yeah, but he's just sleeping all the time.
I think I'd rather be a grasshopper.
Nice dreams. We'll get to Morpheus later. Okay. Anyway, Helios's story is even sadder. It does not involve falling in love with anyone. He's obviously already been in love with someone because he has a son. A son he loves very much, but a mortal son, named Phaethon. No, excuse me, Phaethon.
Does that make him the son of the sun?
Sun.
Yeah, he's the son of the sun. And he was very proud to be the son of the sun. And Helios loved him very much. And so one day he asks his father for a favor, and Helios swears upon the river Styx that whatever he asks, he shall get.
This is bad. Sad.
As we can see, this is always a bad idea. Never swear on the river Styx, especially to something that hasn't been asked yet.
Yeah, I learned that from Percy Jackson.
Yep. So, Phaethon wants to drive his father's chariot. Now, you see, Helios's chariot is the sun. His fiery horses pull so fast and strong that this chariot can race across the entire sky in just one day. And then there's also up there all those other heavenly bodies get in the way. Because remember, to the Greeks, all that stuff up there was kind of on the same plane. Like, you're gonna run into all the constellations, and they're gonna be angry. And, like, one of them's a lion, so better not get too close to that. One of them's a bull. It's just a dangerous place to be. But as Helios has sworn, he has to let his son try to control these uncontrollable horses and make it across the sky.
Oh my gosh, this is very bad.
This went about as well as you might expect.
Oh no.
The sun that day went crazy. It weaved left and right and jumped up and down, burning the land and then freezing it in turn. And eventually Zeus has to put an end to it before Phaethon breaks everything and irreplaceably damages the sun.
I feel like I've seen an episode of The Animaniacs where this happened.
Well, he has to strike the boy down with lightning, so it's not a happy ending. Yeah, no. Phaethon dies, Helios is super sad, and he vows to never let anyone drive his chariot again. Sometimes Apollo does, because Apollo is also a sun god, so sometimes Apollo borrows Helios' chariot, but yeah. So everything is sad. But not everything in Greece is just personified. So these were kind of personifications of the moon and the sun and that kind of thing. And as personifications, people could, like, pray to these beings. Or more often, what happens in mythology is things like this, personifications, just get woven into language. You could talk about Helios's chariot has gone far already, and that would mean it's late in the day because the sun has already crossed so much of the sky. Could talk about, like, by Selene's grace, we meet tonight, which means we meet in the light of the full moon, that kind of thing. Or, you know, I will be up to greet Eos, it means I will be up at dawn, things like that. A lot of this just mixes with the language. And you can even see that in some later stuff. As we've talked about, Greek myth has a lot of place in Shakespeare, and he uses a lot of these in his kind of poetics. He seems especially fond of Selene at times. In any case, there are other things that are not personified that still kind of work to explain the natural world. So, like, one of the biggest concerns of all world mythologies is seasons, because that's how harvests come in. And while there are deities associated with winter and summer, the actual cause of the change in seasons from winter to summer to winter is not a person in Greece, but a story. And you've probably heard it, but I'm going to tell it here anyway. I've already mentioned Demeter. She's the goddess of the harvest. And she has a daughter by Zeus named Persephone.
Oh, Persephone is Zeus's daughter?
Yes, and Demeter's. Yeah, everyone is Zeus's kid. Just to, if you don't know the father, assume it was Zeus. Anyway.
Yikes.
So Persephone is just gorgeous, the most graceful, the most beautiful. She is like a goddess of, I don't know, flowers or spring or fruit or something. She's a, you know, like her mother, a goddess associated with the harvest and with growth and life and springtime, and she's just gorgeous. She is as gorgeous as the most beautiful spring day, as gorgeous as the most wonderful harvest, and just full of grace and light and happiness and goodness and beauty. Mm-hmm. And Demeter loves her very much as her only daughter.
Of course.
But Persephone also catches someone else's eye. Hades.
Not Zeus.
Hades, the god of the underworld.
Protect her from Zeus.
Well, I was going to say Zeus. Zeus is her father, but I don't think that would stop Zeus.
I was going to say, but does in that this ever case, stopped a Greek god?
It is Zeus's brother, Hades. Hades knows that Demeter would never give up her daughter, especially not to him, because no one likes him. So he simply takes her. He just kidnaps her one day. She's out in a field playing with her friends, and a big hole opens up, and he's just like, yoink! And then they go back to the underworld. And the underworld is a place that the rest of the gods don't really frequent, so it's very easy to hide down there. So those two get married. Now, the actual motivations of this myth are really interesting to me. This myth has been retold in a lot of different ways, especially recently. And honestly, I really don't know all the original mythos and the motivation there was. Generally, you hear it told like I just did. He kidnaps her and brings her to this terrible place where everything is depression and darkness, and she hates it there and can't wait to be out. But mythology is something that develops over time, and it serves to benefit and reflect culture. And recently, this myth has been, I don't want to call it just reclaimed, because that makes it sound like this could never have been an understanding to the Greeks. I don't know what the Greeks thought about this story, but recently people have been retelling this story much more in a consensual manner, as if either she was, you know, originally kidnapped but then quickly went along with the plan, or even she wanted to go away. We don't know. Again, it's one of those things. There's not a truth to this story, you know? There might be in this is the oldest version, but, like, that doesn't make it the version. That's the point of mythology and folk tours, is they develop over time, and there are lots of different versions of them.
An idea. A thought.
Yes.
So you said the last episode that it was an honor to be chosen to be loved by the gods, right?
Yes. Especially Zeus.
But that's the thing, is especially Zeus, but all the time bad things happen to Zeus's lovers. Nothing bad ends up happening to Persephone, does it?
Well, it depends on what you mean by bad. That's the thing. She is kidnapped and brought to the underworld. And the underworld is not a great place to be. It's all darkness and sad things and dead people and bleh. Like, it's...
So it's not, so that, like, could be fun.
Considered bad. Well, there are two sides to this story, right? Okay, so the story is she gets brought to the underworld and her mother just gets distraught because of this. And literally the entire world suffers for it. This is the very first winter, and everyone is freaked out. Everything dies, and it gets cold, and the harvest is ruined, and people are dying, and everyone is like, what is this, and how long will it last?
Because, I told y'all about global climate change.
Yeah. Because Demeter is crying, and Persephone's not here, and how does nature function without those two?
1,000 years.
So the gods, of course, go everywhere looking for Persephone. How could she have disappeared? And finally, they get the testimony.
Sorry, hang on. Always winter, never Christmas. Oh, had to say it. Okay, wow. You're welcome. Let's move on. Go on.
Eventually, they find her. They finally think to ask the friend she was with in the field, hey, where'd she go? And that friend... No, it's not even the friend. I think they were witnessed by, like, a cloud or something. And they ask the cloud. And the cloud's like, well, Hades came. And they're like, dang it, Hades. So they go down there, and Zeus demands Persephone back. And here's the hitch in the story. Hades refuses, obviously. And I have to say, I'm kind of on his side here. Especially if Persephone is on his side. This is another point at which a lot of people tell this story differently as far as how exactly it went down. But the main point is Hades gets to refuse because there's this weird rule in the underworld that if you eat any of the food there, you have to stay forever. You can check out anytime you like, but you can't ever leave. Sorry, I had to put that in there. I don't know if Persephone knew this or not. It could be she didn't know the rule, and then she found out she broke it, and she was like, what? That's not fair. It could be that she did know, and she did this anyway. It could be that she did this on purpose because of the rule. But do remember that gods don't really have to eat. They just kind of like the taste. Anyway, while Persephone is here, she has eaten the food of the underworld, a pomegranate specifically, or... More specifically, only 6 seeds of a pomegranate. But they were enough that she had to stay forever. Or not quite forever. Hades and Zeus eventually strike a bargain. Because she ate 6 pomegranate seeds, for 6 months of every year, Persephone will stay in the underworld with Hades. Meanwhile, her mother will mourn and the earth will grow cold. And then for 6 months, Persephone will return to the world above, bringing spring and life back into the world. Thus creating the seasons.
Nice.
And again, the classic myth kind of has this as Persephone is a victim who gets tricked into this terrible life where she has to spend half of her life in this terrible place. But to be frank, Persephone is really good for the underworld. Like, it becomes a nicer place because of her presence. And to be honest, she's a better ruler than Hades. She makes improvements to the underworld. And Hades really loves her and loves having her there. So I quite like a lot of the more modern retellings that have this as, at least in part, a lot more consensual on Persephone's part and gives her kind of more agency in this story. Because a lot of people who say, you know, oh, Persephone is the victim and stuff, never stop to imagine what Persephone's wants could have been. And so, again, it's one of those, it's really interesting. One of the things I really do love about myth is this exact type of thing. You can reinterpret, you can retranslate, you can make this story say different things, and
that.
It works. You're not betraying the old material, you are continuing its purpose. And this is one of those stories that gets really interesting because of that. But, again, it was originally to kind of explain where the seasons come from. So if you really wanted spring to come back, you could kind of be like, ugh, when will Persephone come back? Like, dang it, why did she have to eat 6 of those seeds? Now it's cold. That kind of thing, you know? And so those are some of the major forces of nature. And then, of course, there's Mother Earth. Let's see, who else? There's another personification of nature named Pan.
Yeah. Yes.
Pan, from whose name comes panic and pandemonium. He's kind of the personification of the wild parts of the world. He's a son of Hermes and a wood nymph. You'll get to later. Hermes really likes banging wood nymphs, but anyway. Pan has the legs and ears and arms of a goat. And I don't really have a lot of specific stories about Pan. He's a very mischievous god. He plays the panpipes that are named after him. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of involved in the revels of Dionysus, you know, the Bacchanalia, as it were. He's kind of a leader, I guess, for, like, the nymphs and styres and fauns and the woodland creatures and the river gods and things like that. And they're really who I wanted to talk about next. So, like I said, sorry I don't really have a specific story for Pan.
I do, but it's he's kind of Greek one mythology. Of a
group. Sorry?
I said what'd I you have say? A specific story about Pan, but it's not from Greek mythology.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about Percy Jackson right now.
No, I was going to talk about Prince Caspian. Because
I was going to talk about the Adventure Zone, so...
Wow, there are so many ways we could go with this.
Peter Pan.
Anyway, Pan, the great god Pan, is kind of, like I said, the god of the wild places, and he's very associated with the beings there. And that's where a lot of these other stories come from. So I've gone through some of the big stories, but there are a lot of smaller ones to explain, like, specific parts of nature. And I want to talk more about how the Greeks saw the world. Because the Greeks saw the gods in everything. Tree, god. River, river god. Flower, also a god. And that's not saying that, like, the flower is powerful and we must worship it. It's more like they saw these things as alive. There were spirits. And it wasn't just that, like, maybe there's a dead guy spirit roaming the forest. It's like, no, that tree has a spirit, and the river has a spirit, and whether these things are more powerful or not, for example, rivers are extremely powerful and should not be pissed off, versus trees, which, like, one tree's fine, lots of trees, more intimidating, that kind of thing. But most of these are just explanations of how specific things came to be.
So it's a kind of animism.
In a way, and I think there probably was a lot of animism. When you step back and try to ask how did the Greeks actually worship, I'm sure that there was animism mixed into their worship. They're considered polytheistic, not pantheistic, which means they worship many gods, not everything. So you might not worship all of these things. You're not going to worship a tree because it has a wood nymph in it, because you don't really worship wood nymphs. But you might honor a tree, or especially a river. Rivers are really the important ones here, let's be real. But, like, Ovid's Metamorphosis is just filled with stories that explain the appearance of different types of things, like... Not just, like, this is how trees came to be. It's like, this is how that specific, like, oak trees came to be. There's this song I really like, and I can't tell if it's about becoming a tree or not.
What song? Know.
It's called Happy All the Time. It's a jazzy number by, hold on. Oh, goodness, what's this person's name? It's this really melancholy song called Happy All the Time. By...
About turning into a tree?
Danny Schmidt. I think it might be about a tree. I'm not sure. I'm almost positive it's about a tree. It's weird.
That's awesome.
Anyway.
I'm linking to that. Should I go into a postgrad
poem? You should.
Yes, please.
A lot of things are happening.
Many things.
So many.
Everything happens so much. So... I discovered the past couple of weeks that there are 7 podcasts being made in and around my university, University of Montana.
Oh, nice.
And you, being you, decided to go to the meetup for all of them.
Yeah? I contacted basically everyone and said, hey, y'all want to hang out? And they're like, yeah, sure. So now I have to organize that.
This is your own
nice,
fault.
Nice.
Yeah, which I'm actually really excited about. I don't know if anything will come of it or not, but it looks like it's promising.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
this, the past this feels weeks, like not a problem.
No, hang on. Just go. Bear with.
Okay,
bear with.
Okay.
The and then the last week I got to do a guest voice on a podcast called Arden, which, by the way, is amazing. It is a podcast that's making fun of all true crime podcasts. It's so good. I got to read a wackadoo conspiracy theory, which was super fun.
That's awesome.
It was great. They shouted out my show. I love the Arden cast so much. They're wonderful. I highly recommend Arden. And then just yesterday, after thinking about it for a while and being inspired by our special guest from a few weeks ago, Jared Anderson, I wrote a short story and I submitted it to his podcast as for his hidden lore segment.
Oh, nice.
Of the Crypto Naturalist. Awesome. Terrifying. And PodCon is coming up and I'm making more and more podcast friends every day. And all of these things are happening. My research is actually coming along and kind of working, which I'm shocked.
I still don't get the problem.
I think.
Yeah.
And lately, people have been really nice about in between too, which has been really encouraging. The problem is, how do I continue to enjoy all of this here in the moment, while also not missing out on the opportunities that these present, and like trying to keep moving forward, but also not like obsessing about the moment either. Like, how do I get my perspective so that I'm not constantly preoccupied with all of the things that are going on in podcast land, especially when I'm trying to do my research, but at the same time, you know, enjoy these things while they happen. Like, how do I get my head right, guys? How do I do that?
I mean, I don't think you're gonna like my answer.
Oh, good.
The best kind.
Because this is something I struggle with on multiple levels about multiple things, of just, you know, keeping my head on straight about stuff and not getting distracted by one thing while I'm doing another. You do it.
just do it!
I know that's not
don't
helpful.
Don't let your dreams be dreams!
I know that's not helpful, but on, like, I don't have any grand tactic except just really brutal self-awareness that says, hey, you're getting off track. And it's time to get back on track.
That sounds like terrible advice. I'm sorry.
I know. It's not helpful at all. It's just, like, it takes practice. It's a discipline. Like, you actually have to try.
I'm so bad at this.
You have to try.
Dang it.
I don't know of a magic pill.
There's not a magic pill, obviously. And just because it's a discipline, though, doesn't mean there's not things you can do to practice and make that practice easier.
I just don't know what those things are.
I see your point, Cleo.
Yeah.
I see your point to just, like, be brutally self-aware and mindful. But I would appreciate some tactics if you've got them, Rissa.
I mean, I'm trying to think the practicalities of this. I think one thing is to allow yourself space to be excited and, like, don't constantly be like, no, stop thinking about that. Like, allow yourself genuine space for that. And then only after that is when it's time to, like, pull yourself back. And if you need to, like, ask friends for help with that pulling yourself back thing, like, I don't know, some kind of, not like, accountability makes this seem like too such a serious of a thing, but, like, I don't know, using the resources you have to, like, I'm trying to find words here, but does that make, do you know what I mean?
I'm kind of tracking.
Oh,
what am I being accountable about is, I think, my
well,
problem.
You're the one who said you think you're, like, getting too much of this and, like, losing your head to it.
That's true. So just making sure I'm checking in with people?
I don't know. Or not even checking in with people. Like, that, I guess, is using your resources. But, like, I guess setting rules for yourself is really what I'm thinking of now. Is being like, okay, this is the time for this thing, and this is not the time for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
And yeah, I think that's what I was trying to get at, too, is not that you, like, oh, you're going to completely banish one thing from your mind, because that's not humanly possible.
By sheer force of will.
I will say, now that we started talking about this, I do have one tactic, is that I've found place and sound can be very helpful to me in that.
What do you mean by sound?
That I have a couple of, like, music soundtracks that I only listen to when I'm doing certain things. And so for me, I hear them, it's much more, it's almost like a cue for me to get in the mindset of, hey, I'm doing this thing now. So, like, for studying, I have, like, an album of music that I only listen to when I'm studying. And that is my study music, and it's like, kind of, my brain just, I guess it's like a sound cue. I don't know, self-hypnotism? I don't know. but...
So, what's the experiment with the dogs and the bell?
Pavlov. Yeah, it's Pavlov. Yeah.
So you're saying I should Pavlov myself.
And but also place, because there are places that I cannot... Like, if I'm doing homework, there are places I cannot do homework. Because I just won't get them done. And it's not because, oh, I'm sitting in front of the TV with, you know, a Blue Bloods marathon going. It's because, like, this place just does not, this is not a workplace.
Yeah, okay. Why Blue Bloods?
Yeah, for real.
Because we don't have cable, and for some reason the weird channels we do get constantly doing Blue Bloods marathons. Which, it's a good show,
you
so...
You know what, my grandma really likes that show,
it's,
actually.
It's a decent show, I'm not complaining, it's just, like, a very random thing to marathon. But yeah, that whole idea of having a space that this is my workspace, this is what I do when I'm working, it's kind of, I don't know, for me it just, it's like a physical thing that helps kind of get my brain, it's like an athlete that has a pregame routine, I guess, I don't know.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, that's really helpful.
That does make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
What's funny for me is, now that you mention it, I have these things too, or I had them in grad school a lot, but what's so funny to me is that they changed every time.
Well, that's not helpful.
So every time I had a paper, that paper would have a space, and that paper would have, like, a playlist, and usually it'd be, like, a shortest 5 songs played on repeat for hours.
See, I have...
But then the next time, if I got back to that same space and that same music and tried writing, it's like, oh, this doesn't work. I gotta find a new one.
I have...
All right, I see the justification for that, even though I think in practice I would die.
Yeah. Which, my playlist is a very specific 100-track album that...
That's long.
It is. It's like a giant collection of Vivaldi.
Okay.
The Vivaldi Super Mix.
One time I wrote a paper sitting in the same desk for like 4 hours, listening to like 5 Fall Out Boy songs on repeat all day.
I would hate them forever after that.
No, they're still good songs. What are you talking about?
They might be good songs, but do you like them?
Yeah, they're great. What are you talking about? I only listen to music I like when I'm studying. For a while, especially in undergrad, I had a thing where I had to listen to music to write, but it had to be music without English words in them.
Yeah.
So it could either be instrumental, or it could be in a language I do not know.
Mm-hmm. Or it could be Skaldic lore.
Well, see, my problem is it has to have no words, because I will try to sing the language I don't know.
Wow.
I was doing it last night. I got a hold of this track that was like, we're gonna sing a through the centuries evolution of Jewish music, and I was singing along to the whole thing. In Hebrew.
No.
I don't speak Hebrew.
Cleo, I love you so much.
No, like,
should we move on to what we're into this week?
Yeah, has that been helpful?
Yeah, that actually has been helpful.
Oh, good.
I've got some specific tactics.
My biggest tactic is just to give yourself a time in which it is okay.
Yeah, don't tell yourself, oh my gosh, in order to get everything done, I have to stop being excited about things. Like, be thrilled. It's okay.
Yay. Okay. Thanks, guys.
I can't believe we were actually helpful.
I know. What? That doesn't happen. Record time. I think that took like 7-8 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, Hannah, you should get better problems.
I mean,
I was going to say,
on the one hand, things have been going pretty well for me.
True. Which is good.
Hey, what are we into this week?
So my two things so happened to coincide with my topic, but I swear that they were things before this topic happened.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
They may have had a hand in creating this topic, though. Two things. Have I already mentioned the Zeus Grant Stupid Wishes book?
No.
No, what is this?
Okay, so there's these two books. They're both by the same person, by Corey O'Brien, illustrated by Sarah E. Melville. And if you're not okay with swearing, just ignore these books. There's two books. One is called Zeus Grant Stupid Wishes, and one is called George Washington is Cash Money. And what they are is really informal, short, like, summaries of world mythology. So Zeus Grant Stupid Wishes is world mythology. It has sections on Greek myth, Norse, Egyptian, Mayan, Judeo-Christian, Hindu, Japanese, African, Chinese, Sumerian, Native American, and United States of America.
Oh my gosh.
It's really good, but it's like, this was the one... When I started doing this series, I picked out three books. One is, four books. Two are, like, historical, like Ovid, Hesiod. The other two, one was a children's book of Greek myths, and one was this, which is, like, the opposite. So if you consult the children's book to get the tame story, and this book to get the opposite of tame story, somewhere in the middle ground is probably the case, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the one I've been reading recently is called George Washington is Cash Money. And I think it's super interesting because what it is a retelling of American history and folklore, recognizing that what these stories are, no matter how many of them have any history to them, what these stories are a mythology.
Oh, I love
and they
that.
Fill the exact same gap that Greek mythology filled for the Greeks.
I love that so
it doesn't
much.
Matter how much you explain, how much you believe that George Washington existed, the figure of George Washington is a mythic figure.
That's super cool, the way they're,
cool.
like, bringing in that idea of that parasocial relationship that we have with our own dang founding fathers.
That's awesome, though.
So, they tell all these historic stories, and then they also tell a couple of folklore stories. He tries to get a little bit of Native American folklore in there, but mostly he does focus on, like, the United States of America stuff. And then he tries to get in modern stories. The next one I have to read is on Al Capone.
Nice.
I love me some Americana.
So, yeah, I think, like I said, if you're not okay with swearing, just don't read these books. But if you like the idea of mythology the way I do, these are super interesting retellings because, and what he says was in here, like, if you want to know the actual content of Greek myths and, like, the details, go read a history book.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to be told Greek myths in the same way that they were told, if you want to continue on this tradition of messing stuff up and changing it and all that kind of stuff, read these books. The other thing I've been super into that's been eating all of my time is Assassin's Creed Odyssey, but we don't have to get into that.
It's a good game, fam.
I do have something I've been into.
We're
speaking about books. So I've been reading the Wingfeather Saga by Andrew Peterson, and it's just his young adult fantasy 4-volume epic, and it's a ton of fun. It's really well written and very very deep, but also very silly, and so I'm really enjoying it. He does have an animated series of the saga that's available on Amazon Prime right now, which is supposed to be really excellent as well. I haven't watched it because
I had no clue.
Yeah, I haven't watched it because I'm reading the books first. But I'm in book two.
Know what I'm watching in the lab tonight.
I'm in book two, and it's just really enjoyable. And it has footnotes, which are cracking.
What's the series called?
The Wingfeather Saga. Yeah, there's a lot of fun footnotes, and he'll just, I mean, he makes up all these ridiculous animals and then puts pictures of them in the books, and he yes. has this whole entire world with this history that he, like, puts in the footnotes.
And fantasy authors who use footnotes are my favorite people.
They're all just ridiculous. Cheers to that, mate. And so funny, so you should read them.
What's the first one? Which one's first?
On the Edge of the Dark Sea of Darkness.
Okay, cool. Thank you. What are you into?
I'm into a couple of audio dramas. So
I am in no way surprised. First one,
yeah, I know. Shocking to everyone. I think I'll recommend three. Just give you a little elevator pitch. The first one I already talked about. It's Arden. It's got me hooked, man, on a fake mystery. I love it so much.
Fake mystery.
And it doesn't come with any of the... Yeah, it doesn't come with any of the discomfort that true crime has of, wow, am I being exploitative by enjoying the trauma of this real person?
Right.
Yeah, which always makes me uncomfortable. But the second one is called Zoo, and it's like, it fills the X-Files-shaped hole in my soul.
I didn't realize you had one of those.
Oh, of course. Oh, perpetually, babe, perpetually. It's about a bunch of old FBI cases that this FBI agent is going over, and they all have one thing in common, even though they're from, like, vastly different decades and vastly different locations around the United States, and it's this weird purple sign that just says Zoo.
Whoa.
And it's all cryptids and unexplained phenomena and fun. It's good! It's good.
Nice.
I love it so much. And then finally, I want to recommend We Fix Space Junk, which is not a new podcast, but it is a very good podcast. I've been listening to it nonstop the last couple of days. It's about a basically a repair person who is indebted for her entire life to this evil dystopic company called the Atomicon. And honestly, I find it manages to be lighthearted nevertheless. Like, it's... I find myself enjoying the adventures that these characters go on, despite the fact that, you know, they're kind of in a hopeless situation. Hmm. And honestly, it's kind of cathartic. Because, like, feeling like you're stuck in debt, feeling like you're stuck in a job that you don't want, feeling like this was only the only way to escape where you were, and now that you're here, you don't know where to go next. I find it really relatable.
I feel like I could not watch that podcast, though.
Yeah, I don't know if it's
like,
for everyone.
Even you describing it right now,
That's just what I find appealing about it. It's also brilliantly funny in a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of way. And just mad clever and good. And I love it. And yeah, so highly recommend.
I'm glad you like it.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to our recommendations, to our thoughts, to our mythology. If you'd like to contact us about what you've been into lately, please feel free to email us at theliberalarts@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and Instagram. We want to thank Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our music, and Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design, and also for our intro bit, which made me laugh so hard that I couldn't do it. Cleo had to do it for me. we hope you all have a good day. Would you care to take us out there, Rissa?
Of course, yeah. Thanks for listening, and until next time.
Coming to you from Volcano, the planet Spork is from, on Trek Space, it's the Liberal Arts.
Oh no! I'm sorry!
You can't blame me for that one.
It's too good. That's going at the end of the episode.
Shall we try it again?
Yes, we can. Coming to you from Volcano.
No, dang it! No, it's me!
This is fine. My dad is
Shall I do
why
this?
Why are y'all so loud?